The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, is it loud enough, everyone? Do people can hear me as well? Okay. So, in the last weeks, I found myself drawn to a Navajo expression of walking in beauty. And so I read a little bit about it, and it turns out it's apparently one of the most sacred concepts in Navajo religion. And apparently they're one of the most sacred prayers they have, is a prayer that's about walking in beauty. And I was kind of moved by some of the things I read about how the Navajo hold this concept of beauty. And I saw some of the ways it was described, it resonated or kind of went along with some of the teachings in Buddhism. And I got interested in this idea of beauty in the Buddhist teaching, because I knew that there's a word... That the most common way it's translated to English is good, and so this particular word appears a lot in the ancient teachings of the Buddha, some over 400 times, and over again you read English good, it's good, it's good, it's good, you know, it's good, you know, it's just, it must be good, but I think that good doesn't really evoke a lot of aesthetic resonance or emotional resonance, or, you know, it's, I don't know what it evokes, a little bit moralistic, a little moral, it's good, you know, it's kind of a modest statement, it's good. But if you look up the word, the Pali word that keeps getting translated as good, the first definition that the Pali English, the dictionary gives, is beauty, beautiful. And the teacher I practiced with in Burma, Sayadaw Upandita, one of his books that published in English, based on talks he gave in three-month retreat he gave here in 2003 or something, maybe earlier, it was called maybe some of you remember the title better than I do, A State of Mind Called Beautiful. The title of the book. It's close enough. State of Mind Called Beautiful. But if you look at the dictionary definition or equivalence of these Pali English dictionaries, they give a whole series of words. So the first one I said is beautiful. The second is charming. That's good. Auspicious, helpful, morally good, goodness, and virtue. That's kind of a nice range. And so what it tells me is that it's difficult to translate this word. Now the word, some of you have heard it before, it's kalyana. And it's a very, very popular term in our scene when it's an adjective together with mitta, kalyana mitta, and we use the word good in translating it, but we feel like that's not good enough, so we slip in a word which the Buddha didn't know anything about. It's like outside of his kind of linguistic world, as far as I can tell. We add the word spiritual. Good spiritual friend. And so that's a little more evocative. Oh, it's a friend who's a good spiritual friend. And most classically, it's actually a teacher or someone. But in our kind of scene, it's often used for, sometimes used for, just fellow practitioners who are supportive, helpful, you know. And there's a network of discussion groups people have in their living groups called Kalyanamitta groups. good spiritual friends come together to talk about the Dharma. But what if they're beautiful friends instead of good spiritual friends? You know, does that mean they, you know, been to the beauty parlor? Or probably you don't think that. Probably you think that there's something inwardly beautiful that has related to the spirituality or the practice. So the Navajo word, I can't really pronounce it. I try to look it up to see if I get the pronunciation right, but I'm not going to. Something like, or maybe some of you know better than I do, Hozu. And here's one Navajo was writing about it. It expresses for the Navajo such concepts as beauty, perfection, harmony, goodness, normality, success, well-being, blessedness, natural order, and ideal. So again, you have a wide range of meanings. So there's some kind of concept or some kind of way, understanding or perception or something, recognition of something that doesn't lend itself to something so precise. You know, it's a bit wide range. But, you know, certainly ideal, something that's very important and something that maybe has the heart sing or something that connects us to something very profound that we don't want to limit it just to one word, one concept. And some of the ways that they use this, some of these Navajo definitions overlap with the Buddhist word for dharma, dhamma, and the natural order and ideal and goodness, normality. I don't know what that normality is. What's normal? How things are? But, you know, I was drawn to this idea of walking in beauty. There is an expression in Buddhism called walking in peace, and which I like. I like peace. And, you know, peace and ease that comes from freedom, inner freedom, seems, you know, quite compelling to me. But there's something different about the word beauty. And so in English, the Navajo seem very content to keep translating this as beauty. And I think we should stop translating this Kalyana as good all the time. Good has had its turn. So I think we get a very different sense of the Buddha's teachings if we're reading everyone go through it and say beautiful, you know. And so here are some of the things that range of things that were used for in the ancient texts. One of them is, in fact, referring to, there's a kind of a fable about the Buddha tells about someone who is in love with the most Kalyana woman in the country. So most translators translate that as beautiful, most beautiful woman. He's completely in love with that woman, but has never met the woman, has never met anybody who met the woman. Just as idea, there is such a woman who's the most beautiful and has fallen in love with her. And so the Buddha kind of uses that as a metaphor for someone who's enamored with a certain kind of spiritual state, mental state that the person's never experienced, has never seen, never has known anyone who's seen it, and kind of what their whole life is oriented around this state, which never seen, no one's ever experienced, and so it's like someone who in love with a person that they've never heard, never seen a photograph of, nothing, just the concept, the most beautiful person. So anyway, so there, you know, it's possible it means charming, but beautiful is how the people usually translate it. But that's a pretty rare use of talking about it as a person. It's very common to talk about this Kalyana friend, the beautiful friend, or the virtuous friend, the good spiritual friend. There is, it's the opposite of a word that's most commonly translated as evil. And I'm not very unsatisfied that these English translators keep using the word evil. It's kind of an odd coincidence that the word, the Pali word, the way it's pronounced is papa. So that's just, you know, linguistic coincidences. Somehow the word evil has connotations to me of sin, or there's a very heavy religious kind of connotations here in the West. I don't know if someone is evil, there's nothing you can do for them. It's like you're condemned then. I've tried wicked, but I don't know if that works with how it's colloquially used. Today I was thinking about this and saying, I think we should just translate, let's get rid of good, but let's adopt bad as a translation for it. Anyway, this kalyana is the opposite of this evil. So it's something that's really good, virtuous, morally good, beneficial, wonderful. It's also something that Buddha refers to, you probably heard the expression, some of you probably heard the expression, that the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. So you heard that? Turns out the word is kalyana. So they get a whole different feeling then if the teachings were beautiful at the beginning, beautiful at the middle, beautiful at the end. And it just puts a lot of pressure on the Dharma teachers. There's one here. Here's a little poem that, you know, this idea, you sow what you shall reap. You reap what you sow. I mean, this is a common idea, I think, probably in many cultures, but it's a central idea in the Buddhist teachings of karma. Whatever kind of seed is sown, this is the kind of fruit one reaps. The doer of beauty reaps beauty. The doer of ill reaps ill. So here we have this word beauty. So it's talking about karma. And a number of times when the Buddha is talking about karma, that good karma leads to good results and bad karma leads to bad results, the word for good is kalyana. So you get if you translate that as beauty, you get a very different feeling than good. It removes it a little bit from the moralistic camp. Because often we think of karma as being somewhat moralistic. Do good, good will happen. Do bad, bad will happen. But once you start talking about beauty, like, what is that? And I'm supposed to act in beautiful ways? Boy, it was hard enough to be good. There's a disciple of the Buddha who was apparently quite eloquent, great teacher, and his eloquence is described as that he is a beautiful illumination. Isn't that kind of a wonderful way? He doesn't just teach the Dharma, he illuminates it, but it's beautiful illumination. That would be nice. There's discussion about a practice. The practices that lead to awakening, and those practices are kalyana practices, beautiful practices. So you know, let's get serious about enlightenment. Walk in beauty, live in beauty, discover what's beautiful. Do the beautiful practices. So some of this, there's probably half a dozen stories from the suttas that are repeated over and over again in our particular insight meditation world. And And one of them is the story of Ananda coming to the Buddha's disciple Ananda coming to the Buddha and saying, half the holy life is, and again, the people using the common translation, is good spiritual friends, is beautiful friends, virtuous friends. And the Buddha says, no, Ananda, it's not so. The entire spiritual path is having good spiritual friends. And so that's kind of putting it up high. One teacher I know likes to say that, interprets that partly to mean that it's not just friends in terms of people, but is to be a friend to good spiritual states, these beautiful states. That you're a friend to them, that you kind of, you're in relationship to them and support them, nourish them, informed by them. But then the Buddha goes on to say, if a person has a good spiritual friend, then it's expected that that person will live by the Eightfold Path. And just as the dawn is the forerunner of the rising sun, so a good spiritual friend is a forerunner of someone walking the Eightfold Path. So tremendous importance, at least in Buddhism, in having this relationship to someone whose practice is further along than you, that inspires you to practice, that guides you to practice, and that person somehow is connected to what's beautiful, the beautiful friend, if I keep using this word. There's another word that's translated as beauty, and that is sobhana. And now one of the driest, most soporific piece of Buddhist literature that I know, that's seldom considered beautiful, at least in the initial reading, is seven books called the Abhidhamma. And it's very important for some Buddhists, and you know, if you get into it, it's kind of fascinating. And has both a tremendous value for some people's meditation practice. It kind of gives you the map or the structure of the mind or something. And it lays out with great detail the different states of consciousness that people can have. It lays out something like 52 or 54 important mental factors that come into play. And these mental factors shape the consciousness or the state of mind that people have. There are states of mind in this Abhidhamma that are considered unskillful. There are mental factors that are considered unskillful or unwholesome. So you think the opposite of that would be skillful states of consciousness and skillful states of mental factors. But in fact, this is my favorite part of the Abhidhamma, is that they call it beautiful states of mind and beautiful factors of mind. And isn't that nice that you have this capacity? Your mind has a capacity for beauty, beautiful states of mind. What do you think of that? Do you know that? And there's a whole bunch of them. Apparently, there's more beautiful states of mind that you can experience than there are unskillful states, unbeautiful states of mind. So, you know, it's kind of like tips in the favor of having beautiful states all the time, you know, much more often. And so part of what Buddhist practice is awakening or developing or cultivating or recognizing these beautiful states of mind and having them become a more regular part of our life. And then there are all these, and then it says in this Abhidhamma, that if you have a beautiful state of mind, there will be present in every beautiful state of mind 19 beautiful mental factors, mental little qualities or faculties operating. And you want to know what those are? Since you have them, you know, since you have them, you know, it's like hopefully you recognize yourself in them, these words. Now, I mean, they're kind of, you know, kind of, I don't know if you'd recognize, these words are a little bit, you'd probably choose different words for these things, but some of them. I'll read. So, faith, there's 19 of them. Faith, mindfulness, conscientiousness, and discretion, maybe, non-greed, non-hatred, equanimity, tranquility of the body, tranquility of the mind, lightness of the body, lightness of consciousness, malleability of the mind, malleability of the mind, workability of the body, workability of the mind, proficiency of the body, proficiency of the mind, rectitude of the body, rectitude of the mind. These 19 mental factors are termed universal beautiful factors. Nice, though. And then there's others. There's two other beautiful factors that are called boundless, and they're compassion and sympathetic joy. And then there's a very interesting, there's three mental factors three beautiful mental factors which are responsible for the deliberate abstinence from wrong conduct by way of speech, action, and livelihood. Did you know you had that in you? You have three beautiful mental factors which keep you in check so that you live an ethical life. So it's in there. You know, all you have to do is kind of like tune into them and you'll live ethically. You don't have to kind of read a book on ethics, you know, or have someone kind of reprimand you. You should be, you know, follow the precepts. But rather, you have to awaken or touch into or discover some quality inside which will protect you from that. Those are factors of mind. Yeah, the qualities of mind, the faculties you have. I think that's fascinating. So this beautiful stuff. So what happens if the way you find your way in meditation, the way you find your way in a Buddhist life, the way you find your way in this life, the way you walk, is by tuning into, being sensitive to, smelling perhaps, or something that's beautiful. Beautiful capacity inside. And that's one of the things we hope that happens in meditation, is that we start feeling that this it's beautiful in here. And that sense of beauty doesn't just disappear when we open our eyes, but it's a quality of being that we can kind of tune into, tap into. It's a quality of being that doesn't just have to do with a mental state, divorced from how we live, but it also has to do with how we walk in this world. And part of my attraction to this Navajo little saying, walking in beauty, has to do with the word walking. Because my association with walking is you bring all of yourself along when you walk. And so this idea of bringing all of yourself in with this beauty. And it's hard if you're if you've discovered a state of mind which is beautiful, it spills over. At least I think that's kind of the Buddhist way of seeing it. It doesn't really stay in you. The objective world and the subjective world are not so separate, and so the world starts feeling beautiful. And for the Navajo, they tend to talk about the beauty around them, but you know it doesn't. It, you know, that leaks in. If you tune into the beauty around you, it leaks in here and it kind of permeates us. And so that subjective-objective kind of is not so far away from itself. And so to sit. So the first time I experienced what I would call a kind of a life-changing experience of inner beauty was my first long Vipassana retreat in Thailand. Before that, I had been practicing Buddhism for some years, but the whole virtue side or ethics side of Buddhism wasn't taught by the Buddhist teachers that I was with, and it didn't seem relevant. And I didn't think about it, I didn't have to because I too much myself because I didn't have the enough imagination to do things that are unethical. So, you know, I was safe enough. And but so it wasn't really on my mind. But if anything, if it was my mind, I kind of had a little bit of a, the way I grew up in the 60s and stuff, that, you know, people who were excessively virtuous were a little bit hypocritical or a little bit repressed or a little bit, you know, something was not quite right with them. And so you have to kind of be there in the 60s to understand maybe how that worked. And so I was sitting, meditating, minding my own business, and getting concentrated and still and alert, doing my Vipassana practice. And one of the things that happens in that process is a stilling, a quieting down of what I like to call first the surface mind, the surface chatter that we have. That's sometimes kind of random or not so important. And then we start going through layers. It's kind of like we go through layers of the mind, layers of preoccupation, concerns. And some of these layers, kind of belong to what in ordinary life would be the subconscious, because we're so busy with the chatter on the surface, we're not even noticing what's deeper down and deeper down. And so as we kind of settle and the mind gets quieter, we start going through these layers of the mind, layers of thoughts, ideas, memories, feelings, concepts we have, attachments we have. And they quiet down, or they release, they relax, they settle away. And so this process was happening for me, and at some point, I was amazed, in awe, to experience something, an inner beauty that I had never known before. One of the ways I characterized it to myself was using, again, a word which was in my particular corner of the 60s. You know, I mean, when we talk about the 60s, those of us of my generation, we're talking about a very narrow little sliver of the 1960s, you know, that began here in San Francisco. Little sliver. And so the word that was not really good was purity. And to my surprise, I felt a tremendous feeling of purity inside, of cleanliness. Really felt clean. And I remember that at that time, I remember, wow, this is quite something, that I had this feeling sitting there and day after day having this beautiful feeling of stillness and peace and cleanliness and kind of purity. And then I remembered that in the weeks before coming on the retreat, I had this kind of lust for this woman. And I remembered having that, and then I kind of reflected that in the state that I was in, and the lust was impossible. Whatever that lust was for me, it felt like it would somehow ruin or soil or tear apart or wound or cut into this beautiful state that I was experiencing. And that kind of, wow, this changes my whole relationship to ethics now. If this is where ethics comes out of, it's nothing to do about rules. It's about staying close to something beautiful and living in that beauty. So I continued my practice for more years in Asia. And then there's a little story. I've told this before, but... So at some point I went to Nepal to study with Sayadaw Upandita. He was teaching a month-long retreat there. And I had very little money. I probably had a few $100s. And I was going to be in Asia for the duration. I didn't know what that was, but I was going to figure out how to be there. So I got to Nepal, and I had this girlfriend in the States. So I got there, so I got in the post office's place and called her just to say hello or something. And her roommate answered the phone, and I asked for her, and the roommate said, oh, she went to Kathmandu to find you. Now, Kathmandu is not a small city. She had no address, no nothing. And that's a whole other story, how we found each other, but we did. But she had less money than I did. Now, in the days leading up to her coming, before the retreat that I was going to sit was happening, I just walked around the streets of Kathmandu, and they have these Buddhist shops, you know, with all kinds of Buddhist stuff. And there was one shop that had a Buddha, a metal Buddha statue in the window that I thought that I felt really drawn to. It was something about the statue that really spoke to me. And so I kept going back to that window and looking at it and admiring it and go on. And I think it cost like $100, which was like a fortune, given I had $300, third of my worldly wealth. And so, you know, but I really wanted it. So this is my big question. Should I buy it? It really speaks to me. Or shouldn't I? So that was my walking the streets of Kathmandu dilemma. And then at some point it hit me. The most beautiful thing I know, the beautiful things I experienced to date, I've been a lot of places in the world, seen lots of beautiful places. The most beautiful thing I know is a pure mind. Is to look into your mind and have it be purified and cleansed. That's absolutely the most beautiful thing. That, you know, it's like a natural wonder. It's like better than looking into the Grand Canyon or Half Dome or the ocean or something. It's like the most beautiful thing. And I said, well, that's what's most beautiful. I'm not going to buy that statue. I'm going to save that $100 and help someone else practice to have that experience. And then I think the next day, my girlfriend showed up and she had less money than I. So suddenly I had this $100 I could use, since we used it to travel around a little bit and eventually made our way back to Myanmar, to Rangoon, and did a long retreat there. So this beauty that can be transformative, beauty that can bring out the best in us, beauty that brings us in harmony with the world, beauty that helps us see the beauty in the world. The beauty that comes along with a very important question, and that is, why sacrifice it for anything? Why give it up? What is more important than that? For the Navajo, discovering this beauty is working with fear, working through fear. And they do a lot of ceremonies to help people so they're not afraid. And I think that's probably true for many of us, that fear keeps us from really trusting this potential we have to live in beauty, to live in goodness, to live in this peacefulness, and not to cover it over with attachments and fear and alarm and greed and conceit. In Buddhism, fear is certainly mentioned, but conceit is one of the things that takes away that beauty. Greed is that. Ill will, hatred, hostility. There's all these different states. And it's all too easy that people will give up. Some people give so much more authority to these unskillful states than they give authority to the purity inside, the beauty inside. But what happens if we switch that? What happens if we give more authority, more value, so much so that we're not going to let anything rob us of our purity? That we're going to stay that and find a way to live our life that way and come from that and be that. To walk in peace, to walk in beauty. So I wanted to do, I want to read a little bit to the Navajo. And then I wanted to read this walking in beauty prayer. But then I decided I shouldn't be the one to read it. I'll have a recording of a Navajo person do the blessing or the prayer. That seems better. So I'll say a couple of words and then I'll do the recording. The Navajo do not look for beauty. They normally find themselves engulfed in it. Isn't that nice? They normally find themselves engulfed in it. When it is disrupted, they restore it. When it is lost or diminished, they renew it. When it is present, they celebrate it. The Navajo say in their own vernacular, Sil Hosu, with me there is beauty. In me there is beauty. So with me there is beauty. In me there is beauty. From me beauty radiates. The Navajo express and celebrate this beauty in speech and prayer, in song and dance, in myth and ritual, and in their daily lives and activities, as well as in their graphic arts. Art, therefore, is not divorced from science, philosophy, and theology, but is an integral part of both common activities and cosmic schemes. The concept of Hosu sounds simple, but it isn't. For instance, while other Native American tribes pray for rain during a drought, the Navajo hold ceremonies to put themselves in balance and harmony with the drought. Isn't that an interesting idea? So maybe some of us won't agree with that approach all the time, but maybe more often than you do currently. How do you just accept what's happening and then find how to be in harmony with that? Or maybe accept is not the right word, but harmony, the beauty. So here is it begins with, I think, what sounds like rain. And then it kind of starts. It's just a couple of minutes, or less than 2 minutes, I think.
As I walk with beauty, as I walk, as I walk, the universe is walking with me, and beauty walks before me, and beauty walks behind me, and beauty walks below me, and beauty walks above me. Beauty is on every side. As I walk with beauty. May we always walk in beauty.
And one of the things I came across from the Navajo that, could almost be coming from a Buddhist. Hosu philosophy emphasizes that humans have the ability to be self-empowered through responsible thought, speech, and behavior. Likewise, Hosu acknowledges that humans can self-destruct by thinking, speaking, and behaving irresponsibly. As such, the Hosu philosophy offers key elements of the moral and behavioral conduct necessary for a long, healthy life, placing an emphasis on the importance of maintaining relationships by developing pride of one's body, mind, soul, spirit, and honoring all life. Anyway, I hope that those of you who are doing this Buddhist path and doing meditation practice can maybe consider that there's something about beauty, the beauty of breathing, the beauty of mindfulness, of attention, of awareness, the beauty of loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy, the beauty of ethics, the beauty of restraining from doing things that intentionally cause harm to anyone at all. These are all beautiful capacities that are available inside of you, that are part of who you are. They're kind of a wealth that's waiting for you. What if you live in beauty, walk in that beauty, radiate that beauty, share that beauty with others? What if that becomes the orientation? Maybe what if that becomes the kind of guide or support for your practice, as opposed to some idea of getting concentrated or being more mindful or having some, you know, wonderful, special, I don't know, ultimate experience. Just ordinary, simple beauty that grows and grows and grows. You're all beautiful. Now just realize it. Thank you.